Welcome to the latest edition of the NPM podcast. I'm John Burke, NPM's managing editor. Joining me this week is John Zaransic, president of Americas for Fluence. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John.
So Fluence is a joint venture between Siemens and AES and is a global battery storage and renewable solutions provider. With the energy storage industry continuing to grow in the U.S. and evolving at a rapid clip, I thought it was best to get John's take on some lingering industry trends and Fluence's role in shaping the industry. So, John, with that in mind, can you just walk us through what Fluence's business model is when you interact with BESS storage developers or battery energy storage developers? And walk through trends in the battery storage tech business.
Sure. Yeah. Fluence is a supplier of a fully integrated energy storage solution, right? So that's kind of the core product that we offer. So we pull together best-in-class batteries, power conversion system, the enclosure, all of the subsystems that support that in terms of cooling and energy management, controls, metering, and then all of the software that allows that battery system to do whatever job it's been signed up to do. In some cases, it's emulating jobs that were typically done by power generators. In other cases, it's doing jobs to complement renewables. In other places, it might be acting as transmission. So that's a big part of what we do, is being a system supplier of these energy storage systems. And then we also have another part of our business that's about optimizing and getting the most value out of those systems using digital tools. So we've built a number of systems that allow you to optimize the way that storage system is bid into certain markets to make sure that the owner is generating a maximum revenue, the best use of it. And then we have a number of other digital systems that look at the optimization of over its life cycle. So how is it aging? How are we dealing with maintenance? How are we dealing with degradation and replacement, and helping decision makers look at, when do we augment a system? When do we replace a system? How do we get the best value for the use of the life of the system? So kind of an end-to-end, full complete energy storage system provider. We focus on the technology side, so we don't own or operate these systems as ones that are our own. We help install them for the end owner. We help operate them for the end owner in terms of a maintenance and operations support, but we don't own the systems ourselves. So that's where Fluence fits in the ecosystem. In terms of trends, I mean, you mentioned the biggest trend, which is this is a rapidly growing space, right? So I started in energy storage in 2006, 2007. It was a little bit a lonelier place then. When we would go to the conferences, you know, you could kind of name the, you know, 40 or 50 people that would show up every year. And now this has been incorporated into kind of the overall energy transition space. And, you know, apart from, you know, the days when these were in pilots, now these are full scale, you know, replacement of power plants, replacement of transmission lines, systems. It's in multiple countries around the world. Fluence itself has installed storage systems in 40 countries around the world. I represent the group that's focused on the Americas. So I have systems across the United States, as well as Canada, the Caribbean, and down through South America. So pretty exciting time to be in this as a lot of new technology comes to market, as well as new ways to take advantage of that technology through regulatory structures, new market designs, and just kind of the changing landscape of power needs.
Great. And so what's the breakdown between percentage of revenues in the U.S. versus globally at this point?
Sure. The U.S. is the biggest energy storage market in the world. And so about 70% of our revenue, depends, 60 to 70 something percent, is in the United States.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So as an asset light business, you know, you really get to see the energy storage market, you know, ebb and flow pretty much. What's currently driving U.S. demand for energy storage at present?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a few things that are driving it. I would say one is, you know, we're kind of in a mode where most of the new power generation coming in is renewable power generation, right? That's been that way for a couple of years. As we bring more and more renewables into the system, then we're looking for ways to strengthen the overall grid so that we can take the best advantage of those renewables. So we find in some markets, you have a concentration of renewable power that, you know, generates an enormous amount of power at certain times of the day, but not any at other times of the day. So one of the things that's driving it is spreading some of that out to different times of the day. Another is making sure that the grid itself is strong enough to be able to absorb that and deal with the kind of moment to moment fluctuations. As more renewables are coming in, the kind of a corollary is they're kind of squeezing out the traditional power generation that's been the core of the system operations for a long time. And so those units are either not turned on anymore or turned on much less, or in some cases they're being retired actively. So a lot of older coal units are being retired, marginal gas units are being retired. And as a result, you don't have as much of the predictable, stable, controllable base of power generation that you used to have. And so when we do see like an extra hot day or a spike in demand or a drop in demand for something, something on the system has to be able to compensate for that rapidly. It has to be a dispatchable, controllable power source. And that's really what storage is very good at. It's almost instantaneous power. It can be controlled very, you know, finitely. So you can get the exact output at the exact time that you need. And it substitutes for a lot of what used to be peaking plants or rapidly scalable plants, things that had a lot of flexible power generation. So those are kind of two of the big drivers. And the third one is just generally the turnover of infrastructure. You know, there's aging assets that just have reached the end of their life, either the end of their useful life or the end of their economic life. And as they retire, something else has to come in to fill that void. And storage has been one of the key technologies coming in. It's easy to site and permit relative to a power plant. You know, it doesn't have emissions of any kind. It doesn't have big, loud sound issues. It doesn't have a high visual profile. It doesn't use water. It can be sited in areas that today would be nearly impossible to put a power plant of any type. So in an urban area, in a suburban area, a lot of times we have electrical infrastructure there, but we don't have the ability to put something there. Nobody wants a power plant there anymore. So, you know, that's a big advantage, and we can build this infrastructure relatively quickly. So typically an energy storage project from, you know, the owner saying go to having it in operation is something like a year. So it's relatively fast. It's easy, much easier to permit. And so it's becoming a choice for flexible power capacity in the United States and around the world.
Appreciate that. So in Fluence's annual report early this year, the company pointed to two central mechanisms that were accelerating storage development. The bipartisan infrastructure bill from now November 2021, which led to the U.S. Department of Energy issuing notices of intent to issue $2.91 billion to boost production of advanced batteries, and later the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, which passed in August of 2022, sure, which of course involved the introduction of a standalone investment tax credit for the first time. An investment tax credit for standalone storage for the first time, right. Plus the usual adders that went to other renewable verticals. What's your assessment for each legislation in terms of when we might get to see an impact?
I think, you know, these things go in cycles a little bit. So I think the fact that we're seeing legislation is a testament to the fact that storage has come in and has been so impactful, and there was a desire to accelerate this. And so then a lot of what we've seen in this legislation is trying to align storage with some of the things that we've done for other beneficial technologies that have existed. So we had the investment tax credit for renewables. We've had that for years and years. It's been a big piece of how that industry has been built in the United States. Up until now, you actually haven't been able to do standalone storage and get the same investment tax credit treatment that you would get if you did storage at the same adjacent site as a renewable. So, you know, years and years ago, we worked on the very first storage site to qualify for an investment tax credit, and it had to be located on the same property and on the low side of the main step-up transformer with the renewable to qualify for the investment tax credit. That was the interpretation of the rules at the time. Energy storage was always contemplated in the investment tax credit rules. If you go back to the original proceedings from the 1970s that created this whole legislation originally. Energy storage and batteries on the grid were cited in that legislation. They just didn't emerge immediately. The technology needed to mature. So it makes sense. The industry has been saying for years, hey, we should be able to do standalone storage the way we're doing renewables. I used to talk to Terry Boston, who ran the PJM interconnection for many, many years. And, you know, when we put that first investment tax credit storage project in, we combined it with a wind project on a mountaintop in West Virginia. That was the very first storage to get an investment tax credit. And Terry said, I don't need energy storage on a mountaintop in West Virginia. I need it in Philadelphia. I need it in the congested parts of PJM, you know, interconnection. And we said, yeah, but the policy is driving us to pick sites that maximize that benefit, you know? And so I think what's happened with this legislation is it's really resetting and kind of bringing to parity the landscape for doing these projects. There are standalone storage projects that have been done over the years. We've done a number of them, some of them quite large, over 100 megawatts, a couple hundred megawatts, but they've been done just on the base economics of those. And that hasn't been as fast as if you had these other incentives that are intended to accelerate the mass rollout of energy storage. So what this did in the IRA in particular is, one, it reaffirmed the 30% investment tax credit, which was in a phase out, you know, kind of ramping down. Two, it offered that you could do this as standalone storage, which makes all the sense in the world. Why have a difference in those two things? Let the relative economics and benefits of the systems drive the investment rather than this strange policy distortion. And three, it created some incentive bonuses if you produced domestic content that was used in the creation of the storage systems and in the renewables, and it created a benefit if you did these in energy zones that are, you know, areas that are seeing you know, the prior facilities and prior production facilities leave. So those are big changes. You know, one, just to reaffirm long-term policy around these tax credits. Two, the standalone portion I think is opening up another part of the market entirely. That existed, but was not moving as fast as I think it will move now. And then three, we're going to see this, I think, supply chain impact where we will start to see more domestic production of the key materials that go into energy storage and other things. The U.S. is already the largest storage market and one of the largest electric vehicle markets. So it makes sense for a big portion of the battery supply chain to be located here. Today, it really isn't. It's mostly located overseas in Asia.
So what challenges have you seen, you know, battery and renewable developers face as they try and meet the rapid demand for these assets? And how has technology been helping them overcome these challenges? And let me contextualize a little bit more, sure. You know, by seeing that I've seen and heard from a number of people that there is an expectation that the pricing curve is supposed to go down over the next, you know, through the rest of the decade, through many different vessels, you know, expectations of interest rates falling, the supply chain logjam easing up as these gigafactories get built in the U.S. You know, and so everybody's got a sense that these battery projects are going to be just more eminently affordable as opposed to what they once were. So with that as the backdrop, just wanted to get your sense on that, as well as what you consider sort of the main obstacles towards getting these projects built.
Yeah, well, I think maybe I'll take it in two.
It's a two-parter, John. That's okay.
You know, one I think is kind of the industry issues that you're talking about with the supply chain and interest rates, some macro issues. The other is like what actual developers and owner operators are facing. Yes. I think, you know, the developers and owner operators, they've become much more sophisticated. You know, we're working with customers that are experienced with what they need to do to find a quality project. They're experienced with what they need to do to bring, you know, whether that's a contract or a mix of revenue streams together to get that finance. You know, one of their challenges is finding a strong partner on the technology side that's a bankable partner so that they can bring You know, these projects generally are getting larger. So a few years ago, we were doing, you know, on average 20 megawatt projects that might be 1 hour in duration. Now we're doing projects that on average are more like 50 or 100 megawatts and 4 hour plus in duration. And so when you talk about capital, you know, you've gone from something that might have been 10 or 15, $20 million, mostly financed on somebody's balance sheet, to projects that are 100, 200. We just did one that's over $500 million. And those are not largely focused on balance sheet financing. They're focused on bank and debt financing, like most of the renewable industry, right? So you need a partner that can stand behind the technology, that has a proven track record of getting it installed and working and delivering the kind of performance that it needs. So that's one key challenge that those you know, owner, operator, developers are facing, is who's a credible partner to work with. And then as they're doing more and more at scale, you know, these people aren't developing one project at a time now. They're developing 10 or 15 or 20 in a whole pipeline. And they need those to show up. You know, one of their biggest risks is if those systems don't show up on time, it pushes everything out. If they miss the calendar year, they miss, you know, the window for that ITC year. The people that are buying the tax credits, in a lot of cases, there's third-party financing of this. They miss that whole tax window. So timing around this becomes a huge issue. And we've seen all kinds of things impacting timing. So I think trying to work with a supplier that has, you know, good access to the battery systems, they have the ability to actually deliver it on time, get it working, pass the test, deal with any market changes that have come about, and doing that at a bigger scale, you know, it's different than when we were doing this a few years ago, where, hey, this might have been one project and you were doing a dozen solar projects or multiple wind projects. And if your one battery project didn't come online, it didn't make that big a difference. But now it's been embedded in most of the main pipelines. It's actually very significant amounts of capital and very significant amounts of earnings for those companies. And so they want to make sure that they're scaling appropriately with their partners and really getting that certainty. So those are some of the challenges that I think people are seeing. Once they get into service, the next challenge is, oh, now I have a fleet of these storage systems. How do I make sure that I actually know how to supply them, maintain them, get the most value out of them? And that's where we've been building these digital tools, like our Nispera platform for asset management. We've been building the Mosaic platform for revenue maximization. We work with people on a number of services to support that, so that they can look at this not on a, you know, one battery at a time view, but as a kind of a platform of assets, right? And they can think about their capital strategy, their maintenance strategy, their revenue strategy around a whole platform that works, you know, with a similar level of reliability. So that's kind of on the maybe developer, owner, operator challenges that they've had. And I, you know, then you step back to some of the macro issues. I mean, the last few years have been, you know, maximum challenge, right? We saw, you know, we've seen high inflation hitting prices. We've seen disruptions in the shipping. So anything we were trying to bring into the United States, you know, at one point, it wasn't even a matter of cost. It was, could you even get a vessel at all? And then if you could get a vessel, they were exorbitantly expensive. And you're starting to see cost of shipping being a major item when it's had been a minor item. So fortunately, cost of shipping has been coming down pretty steadily, and we've been able to work with our partners to make that better. Just about the time that cooled off, we had this massive run up in the, you know, cost of raw materials. Most significantly, in some of the raw materials that go into batteries had, you know, multiple 100% increases, you know, over a relatively short period of time. And so you had an industry where pretty much every year you could count on the cost of the battery coming down by some percentage. You know, some years it was a couple percent, some years it might have been as much as 8 or 10%. And all of a sudden we were seeing battery prices going up 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% over a relatively short period. And that was pretty difficult for most of the developers. You know, they have multiple years invested in a site, in an interconnection, multiple years invested in negotiating a revenue stream and establishing financing around something, and then you've got to go to install it. You can't go back to the beginning and renegotiate everything. And so we've worked with a number of our customers to help them go back and in some cases renegotiate prices with the market with the offtaker, extend projects, look at how to do things to take advantage of, you know, what are we doing now versus later, augmentations, you know, maximize the benefit to them so that they could keep projects moving in a very high inflation environment. The last couple of months now, we've started to see costs of those raw materials coming down again. And so some of that's driven by slower growth in China. You know, some of it's been driven by generally easing growth around the world. And so, you know, it's a big question mark as we go forward. Will we see that tighten up again, you know, quickly? I think the supply chain costs are tricky. I think there's enough value there, but it's disruptive when it comes out very, very rapidly. And so those are some of the macro issues that we're dealing with. Obviously, things like the Inflation Reduction Act help quite a bit with that. One, they're providing a tax credit that brings the cost of the total system down. They give some certainty, and it helps absorb some of those price shocks. The other thing that we're doing is several years ago, mainly in response to demand increases and seeing some of this supply chain disruption, we started moving towards domestic production of certain components of our system. And so today we already do assembly of these units in the United States, and that reduces the amount of shipping and reduces the amount of uncertainty and timing. We are moving to full domestic production. And so the Inflation Reduction Act, with its credits towards domestic production, has, you know, basically accelerated the efforts we were already on to have production in different parts of the region to meet where demand is. And so we expect to have full domestic production compliance, you know, next year, shipping product next year. Some of those rules are still getting finalized, so we're tuning that as the latest guidance comes out. But we've taken the steps, we've made the investment to make sure that our customers are going to be able to get domestically compliant product that falls under the investment or the Inflation Reduction Act, and they can get the added bonuses for that.
Great. So what we've been seeing lately is that, you know, there obviously is interconnection log jams for everybody right now, and the likes of PGM and MISO.
Sure.
And, you know, right now, combined with rising costs, the projects are playing a little hot potato right about now. People are getting in at an early stage, and some of them are maybe selling it right now, you know, depending on what their patience is for holding, or why they're holding onto these assets, or why they're choosing to exit it. But it's very dynamic. It's a very fluid market right now in terms of the battery projects that are being offered up for a potential sale, and why they're being offered up for a potential sale.
Sure.
How does that impact somebody like Fluence? I'm just curious on that front.
I mean, it impacts the timing of getting things to completion usually. So most of the people that we're working with, you know, they have lots of interconnections in, they have projects at various stages of life. Where those are getting delayed, it has a tendency to either elongate the project or delay its end. In a lot of cases, we're working with them on ways to work around that, to keep the schedule moving, and so on. You know, I think it's a bigger problem for the solar and wind industry at the moment, because there's so much more of that than there is of storage, but it's a problem that, you know, is trickling down through storage and other things. I do think the ability to do standalone storage in some places is actually beneficial, because in a lot of cases, you can put storage in locations that don't require system level upgrades. In some of the developers and customers we're working with are scanning the grid to look at places where they already have, you know, a transformer connected, a retiring asset, something where they can go through an expedited interconnection process and not have to do the same level of study or upgrade that's coming with a lot of these large renewable projects that are in the outlying areas. So that's one advantage that storage has relative to others. But I think we generally have an interconnection problem, you know, as a country. It's one of these kind of snowballing problems, in that people are uncertain about how fast things are going to get through that queue. And so their tendency is to put more into the queue to make sure that something comes out the other end. And it creates this, you know, continually bigger problem, right? It's a, you know, there's more to study because more is going in because people are less certain about something coming out the other end. And it's creating a more and more complicated process. So ultimately, with the state of technologies that we have today, it seems like there's got to be a way that we can advance the way we review and look at interconnection to still be able to provide protection and reliability without having to go through these multi-year studies of the system. And so I think that's an area, you know, it's an area for good people to put their heads together. A lot of people are talking about it and thinking about it right now. And I, you know, I suspect it'll be one of the limiting factors on how fast we can achieve some of these ambitions around renewables.
Yeah. Seems like we are every ISO has their own sort of reforms in play to try and fix this system, but it's a very long process. There's no easy
solution. It is. And even at the distribution level, we find long waits in some cases, even if people are going around the transmission level. So it's kind of a systemic infrastructure access problem. I think the more ways you have to come at it, the better. And that's where I think storage does help. In some cases, storage can eliminate some of the congestion points. So we've been working in Europe with a number of customers where we're doing very large scale systems of storage coupled to the transmission system to eliminate some of the holdbacks on the transmission system. So, you know, for transmission reliability planning, a lot of times there's significant spare capacity on the transmission system that's reserved against a line failure, reserved against a unit failure. So essentially, one way to think about it is we're holding a bunch of reserve transmission capacity kind of back from the market against the possibility of a failure, an outage, an event. By putting storage onto the grid, we can alleviate transmission capacity that we've already built and have the storage act as the backup in that situation. That's happening in Europe already. It's happening selectively in the United States, but I think that's the next wave. That could free up a good bit of transmission capacity. It could advance some of these storage interconnection queues that are getting stuck waiting on system upgrades or system studies. So I think there's lots of ways that storage can actually contribute to making this problem or easing this problem, I guess.
Okay. Well, we're well into the program, John, and neither you and I have mentioned the word lithium yet in the past 25 minutes, which I'm a little shocked by, actually. But this leads to my next question about where we are today in the market in terms of these batteries. You talk to people, I talk to people, they say lithium ion, short duration is still a very prevalent technology. It's not going anywhere. And then on the flip side, we learn about these new technologies that are starting to evolve and starting to gain greater acceptance. These are longer duration. These are alternatives to lithium ion. California, which is obviously the laboratory for renewable energy at this point in this country, you start to see a lot of these technologies emerge, but not the only state. It showed up elsewhere. To bring around to an actual question, I would say, what are your thoughts on lithium ion right now in terms of being the dominant storage provider? And does that need to change in a sense because of like the confluence of both batteries for energy storage and batteries for electric vehicles, which is also a growing trend, which we haven't talked about quite yet.
Right.
And then part three, this is a 33-part question. Alternative technologies, what's starting to gain greater acceptance in your mind, and why are they gaining greater acceptance?
Sure. Well, I would start by saying, you know, we're fairly agnostic. So, you know, we look at this as, you know, partly a commercial problem as much as it is a technical problem. And so it's a question of what technologies line up to do the jobs that we need to do on the grid at price points that provide value. You know, they lower the cost for consumers. They provide more value than they cost. That's really been our, you know, starting point with energy storage for more than 15 years. We saw this as a better way to build a mousetrap, you know, and when we first started, we were looking at things that were mostly 15 minutes in duration, then 20 minutes, then an hour, and so on. And at those times, the characteristics that make lithium ion attractive in terms of batteries are, one, you get almost all the energy back out of the battery that you put in. So the batteries themselves are 99% efficient. You know, you lose some efficiency in the power electronics and in the transformation, but you still get a system that's very efficient, right? And so that's good. If you generate the electricity you want and you store it, you want to get most of it back out. So that's there. Two, they can react very, very rapidly, cycle very fast in either direction. So there are some storage technologies that don't change directions very quickly, or they have a relatively low rate of charge or discharge. And so those create limitations. You know, people have tried things with lead acid batteries and other all kinds of forms of advanced ones in the past. And those were some of the limitations that you got. So you couldn't use as much of the energy. You couldn't change directions quickly. You couldn't go at higher, you know, power intensity rates, which is what we need. And then it's mass produced, and it's mass produced for the transportation industry, for the consumer electronics industry, and for the power industry. So in some senses, we're getting the benefit of the fact that these batteries can be used for multiple applications. And so we're getting this scale benefit in the power industry. If we were just building this for the power industry, we'd be a fraction of the demand that exists today for lithium ion batteries. And as a result, the cost of all of this would be higher. Maybe just go back 5 or 10 years and you look at the scale of demand for lithium ion batteries then compared to now, we were at a much higher price point. And all of that mass production, learning, know-how, incremental CapEx investment in research and development and in production has driven the cost of this down, 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 down. So those are really the advantages of lithium ion. As I said, when we started, it wasn't a 4-hour product. It was mostly like a very short duration product. You know, we used to call short duration under an hour. Now we're starting to call 4 hours short duration, right? And in contrast. And what we found is when you look at the market for value, there's a big bucket of value in terms of supporting the system in sort of less than an hour to an hour duration, a lot of very immediate quick jobs. There's another bucket of value sort of around 2-hour systems. That's a lot of what's driving ERCOT now. Then there's another bucket of value around 4 hours. It's really kind of like a, you know, system reliability, capacity type market. And then people have now started to look at saying, hey, well, there's another bucket of value that you get to 8 hours. All of those increments require more capital, right? So, you know, to go from 1 hour to 2 hours, you need twice as many batteries effectively. To go from 2 hours to four, you need twice as many again. To go from four to eight, you need twice as many again. So your capital cost goes up quite a bit, right, in that system. The incremental value you capture with each hour goes down, right? So there's some curve where you say, hey, depending on what the system costs me and what the value it generates, we're crossing. And I would say today in most markets, you know, we're somewhere between 2 and 4 hours makes economic sense. In some markets, we're starting to see 5-6 hour systems. We've done a number of 5+ hour systems in South America and other places. California is now doing some 8-hour systems. Some people have looked at 12 hours in pilots in New York, but those aren't really fully commercial. So I think that's really what drives this, is that relative difference between the value curve and the cost curve, right? As the cost curve comes down, we'll see systems get longer. If the value curve keeps going up, where we say, hey, there's value to having these longer duration systems that can do more, then we'll see that come too. So as I said, we're agnostic. We think lithium ion makes a lot of sense for the reasons we said, but we've also brought other technologies into our portfolio. We've worked with a number of other suppliers of different things to be kind of a, you know, technical trial partner, a joint development partner. We look at other things. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on with improvements to anode and cathode material that will make material differences, you know, in life, in cycle performance, in cost, in safety. There are these alternate chemistries, like you're saying, you know, iron air. There's stuff coming with sodium ion. There's a lot of stuff. We generally haven't seen as much with the vanadium stuff coming, just because it's kind of tended to stay at a higher price point, but there's some interesting things there for certain applications. But, you know, we've been more focused on large scale, large portfolio that you can implement reliably. You know, our customers can invest capital reliably We can know how it's going to perform reliably over its life. We can augment and service and maintain it. Today, that's around the lithium ion product. I think as it goes forward, we'll bring other batteries into our system. We can put them under the same controls, same power conversion, and we do those experiments with people as it makes sense. So the good news is lots and lots of, you know, capital flowing into the space that's driving innovation. It tends to take a while to go from kind of breakthrough to lab scale to initial production to really full scale bankable production. So these technologies in the power industry, anyways, they don't jump over that chasm very quickly. You know, to go in the power sector, reliability is a very key topic. You want to make sure that whatever you installed, it's going to work reliably. That takes some track record improving. Like I said before, a lot of this industry is driven by financeability. So financiers want to make sure it's something that they can see, you know, they're not taking undue technical risk. So those are the things that force maturity, right? And I think, you know, we bring those new technologies in as they're ready, you know, and as they're ready to mature.
So to cap this program off, are there any technologies now that you think are going to be ready in the short term?
Like I said, more of our focus, I think, is on these improvements to the lithium ion, where people are making advances around the anode and cathode stuff. Sure. There. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff on the power electronics side where we're seeing improvements there that in some senses is kind of the weak point of the system, because, you know, power electronics, you know, they have their ups and downs of things. That's been a constrained supply also. So those are really interesting. And then I think the more interesting part actually is the intelligence piece of this. And what do we do with all the information that we collect? So compared to some of these other systems that we have, if you think about a solar facility or a wind facility, you know, that kind of creates energy when the sun's shining and you take it as you get it. You can do a certain amount of performance tuning, but it's really kind of at the margins. You can up-tune or detune the inverter to get a little bit more or less power. You can think about how you do maintenance or washing. I mean, big debates on whether to wash panels or not wash panels, stuff like that. But you're basically going to get the production that comes as a result of the solar resource, the wind resource, or so on. With batteries, you've got bi-directional capability. So you can absorb or you can discharge energy. You can decide, am I using that capacity today or am I using it tomorrow? You know, based on how I consume the battery over its life, it may make sense for me to use it more intensely now and have to do capital replacement in a few years from now, or it may make sense for me to wait based on where those power prices are and what the relative value is. So you have a lot more decisions to make in energy storage, and you have decisions on a resource that can change directions in under a second. We have systems out there now that are responsive at less than 100 milliseconds. So every 100 milliseconds, you could be making a dispatch decision for how to maximize the value of that energy storage system. Compare that with even a conventional power generator where, you know, you're taking minutes to materially change output. And so you're talking about, how do I maximize the revenue and the life of a system that could either charge or discharge, could do those changes in direction on, you know, second by second basis, and can bid into multiple products in a market. And a lot of those products are going from 1 hour bid to 15 minute bid now to 5 minute dispatch and settlement. So you've got a very complicated set of optimizations. And that's really where we're going with machine learning, artificial intelligence, through our Mosaic bidding platform and Nispera asset management platform. Those are getting beyond the scale where humans can make the best optimization decisions, because there's too many choices in too short a time frame. And so we've been working on things that allow you to compare, you know, perfect dispatch with what you actually did and then learn from that and optimize it. So the fleet managers that we're working with, the people that we're really thinking about, it's not just the installation of the core systems. One, we're doing that. We're doing it with controls that allow you to take the best advantage of it, but then we're building the intelligence layer so that somebody can actually get the full value out of it, optimize it in the moment and over its life. So when I think about technologies that are coming here, batteries is one exciting part of technology, but it's, you know, to some degree, somewhat slow moving compared to what we're seeing in AI and machine learning. It's very, very rapidly evolving. And as the systems are taking advantage of storage in a bigger and bigger way, there's lots of value around the way you dispatch, the way you optimize, the way you maintain these systems. So when I think about excitement, that's probably more, even more where my excitement is.
Great. Well, that's about all the time we have. John, thanks so much for joining the program today. And we'll hope you all tune in next time. Perk out.